This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Fraser Nyman is the Director of Archaeology at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. He joins me live in studio. Fraser, it's good to see you.
Good to see you again,
thanks
Coy.
Thank you for being here. Absolutely. So lots of very exciting things going on. We're going to spend a little bit of time here talking about archaeology at Monticello and what we've learned from the archaeology there. Let's start, if we can, with sort of the three initiatives, the three big things that you work on that are always front burner for you.
Okay. Excuse me, Coy. I'm getting over a cold here, so you may have
to. Yeah, and the pollen doesn't help.
Suffer a little hacking. Well, as we discussed a little bit earlier, our work is really structured around three major ongoing initiatives, and just mention those briefly here. The first is something we call the Mulberry Row reassessment. As you know, Mulberry Row is the 1,000-foot-long street of outbuildings and slave houses that stood right next to Jefferson's neoclassical mansion. And during the 1980s, my predecessor at Monticello and colleague Bill Kelso did a series of major innovative excavations there on the excavating domestic sites where many of Jefferson's slaves, skilled artisans, and house servants had lived. So one of the things that's on our plate is to try to go back and understand that mass of material. Bill, you know, made some really cool discoveries, but the material is so rich and so complex, he really was able to only kind of get the tip of the iceberg. So that's the first our first major initiative. The second one has to do more with field work than analysis, and it's the Plantation Archaeological Survey. As you know, the foundation owns actually a little over 2,000 acres of land surrounding Monticello Mansion, and that's the 2,000-acre core of Jefferson's original 5,000-acre plantation. And that gives us a really amazing opportunity to begin to understand on a landscape scale patterns of settlement and agricultural land use, ecology, during Jefferson's lifetime. So that's number two. And then number three is a program that actually gets us or tries to ensure that we don't get stuck in a kind of myopic view of Jefferson and Monticello and try to begin to understand him in a larger context, both of the Chesapeake region, but also the sort of South Atlantic world that really whose economy was based on slavery. And by that, I mean the Chesapeake, the Carolinas, and into the Caribbean. So DAX is an attempt to assemble and actually make available on the internet for anybody who wants to get access to it, really detailed, fine-grained archaeological data from sites associated with slavery in all three of those regions, the Chesapeake, the Carolinas, and the Caribbean.
And DAX is what? That's
DAX is it's one of those terrible acronyms, which we use it so much, I almost have forgotten what it stands for. Originally, it stood for the Digital Archaeological Archive of Chesapeake Slavery. But our funders liked our work in the Chesapeake so much that they asked us to expand into the Carolinas and the Caribbean. So we had to think of another C word. And so we came up with comparative. So now it's the Digital Archaeological Archive of Comparative Slavery.
And this, for folks who don't know, this is truly a research project of international renown. You're doing something no one has ever done before, really comparing apples to apples across a tremendous region here and looking at the life of generations of those who lived were slave laborers
in that time period. Yeah, I mean, archaeologists have always talked about trying to, you know, compare systematically how slaves lived, for example, on sugar plantations in Jamaica with how they lived on tobacco plantations in the Chesapeake. But one of the things that's stymied us has been the annoying fact that different archaeologists like to describe their stuff in different ways. So this means that, you know, even if you could get access to somebody's cataloging records, et cetera, you'd be faced with this apples and oranges problem of, you know, what did he really mean by this? So this is a problem in the entire discipline of archaeology and many other disciplines as well. So one way around it is to try to put together, sort of consult widely with our colleagues who work on this stuff. Ask them, you know, what would you like to know? What are the classification and measurement protocols that have worked the best for you? We can write those up, codify them, train our analysts to execute them, and then go out there, collect a bunch of data so that it all plays well together.
We're talking with Fraser Nyman, the director of archaeology at Monticello. That's no less, Fraser, than really a revolutionary movement in historical archaeology, because this is something the discipline has needed for so long, for somebody to finally come along and say, let's compare apples to apples here, right, so that we really understand what we're looking at.
That is the hope. That is the hope. And the other piece of it is that by making all of this stuff available to anybody anywhere on the internet, we kind of magnify the effect by inviting our colleagues and just, you know, students, anybody who's interested to try to, you know, have a go at analyzing these data and trying to make historical sense of
it. Now, it's only a few years old, but what have we learned thus far from DAX, from this, you know, really brand new way of looking at the record of slavery in this region?
Yeah. Well, here's one example. One of the things that historians have been very interested in is the extent to which, and actually change over time, in the extent to which enslaved people throughout the Atlantic world were able to participate in this large movement called the Consumer Revolution. This is during the sort of late 17th and 18th centuries. For the first time, really, or maybe not for the first time in world history, but historians have detected a kind of what I like to think of as an uptick, really throughout the Atlantic, in the extent to which not only wealthy people but ordinary people, and perhaps even slaves as well, the extent to which they were willing to expend their hard-earned resources on fashionable, fancy, but in the last analysis, useless stuff. this is kind of we're dealing here with the sort of origins or the rise of popular consumer culture and conspicuous consumption in the Atlantic world. So one question is, you know, well, when did this movement, or did it, reach people who were enslaved and working on, say, sugar plantations in Jamaica or plantations here in Virginia? And this is where the comparative perspective really becomes kind of cool. It turns out in Virginia, when we array our multiple sites, and actually this is work done by Dr. Jillian Galley, who runs the DAX project. I'm just the window dressing. This is work that Dr. Galley's done, and she's found that when she looks at Chesapeake sites, we see pretty low levels of participation in the consumer economy until we get to the end of the 18th century, when there's a really exponential increase. And that raises the question, well, what causes that? One potential idea is that may be linked with a larger trend in the Chesapeake region, which involves economic diversification. That is to say, for most of the 18th century, most of the economy was dominated by tobacco culture. We get to the end, we begin to see the emergence of towns. We begin to see tobacco planters beginning to plant wheat as well. Jefferson is a great example. And we wonder if these developments sort of restructure slave mobility patterns and their ability to earn cash for themselves and make it more likely that enslaved people will run into other enslaved people whom they don't know. And it's in that context of running into strangers that that maybe being fashionable, having cool ceramics, having an up-to-date suit of clothes becomes more valuable. So we see this pattern in the Chesapeake, this change in the Chesapeake towards the end of the 18th century, and it seems to be correlated with economic diversification. So one way we could test this causal link is by looking at some comparative evidence from a region where there isn't a shift, an economic shift, and into more diversified production. And that's where the Caribbean is a really interesting test case, because in the Caribbean, it's sugar, sugar, sugar all the way through until emancipation in the British Empire, which is 1834 to 1838. So when we look at, again, sort of data all cast in the same way, we look for these same trends in the Caribbean, we see that participation in the consumer economy is pretty constant through from the mid to the late into the early 19th century. So that the fact that there is no change, where we see no change in the kinds of crops that are being
supports
produced,
the hypothesis that
supports the idea that the change in Virginia, right, is in fact causally linked, not just correlated, with this change in
crop. So the death of tobacco
production
as the main crop in the Chesapeake could be the birth of the real consumer culture among African Americans.
Yeah, that's sort of our current
that's
hypothesis
really fascinating.
That there's a linkage there. But again, I mean, this is the thing about historical evidence is, we can't do experiments, right? So in order to evaluate causal hypotheses, we have to have comparative evidence and rely on sort of the natural experience that different regional trajectories have provided.
We're talking with Fraser Nyman. He is the director of archaeology at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. The phone lines are open. If you got a question, 977-1070. Fraser, let's go back to Mulberry Row, mm-hmm. which visitors around here and folks who visit Monticello, we're very familiar with Mulberry Row. You leave the house, you walk down, you see the little stone foundations of the buildings that were there. I've always been captivated by that question, will Monticello bring Mulberry Row back? Will it rise from the ground again? And will we see sort of a little colonial Williamsburg type of experience on the landscape?
Right.
And so that you'll actually see for yourself that this wasn't a park, that this was a place where, dozens of hundreds of people lived mm-hmm. and worked, and mostly African American.
Right.
So that's always interesting to me. What have we learned about Mulberry Row, about slavery at Monticello through the archaeology? What does the archaeology tell us about that aspect of Monticello?
Well, actually, a bunch of pretty cool things. One place to start actually is with the house foundations themselves, the houses themselves. One of the trends that really pops out from the results from the 80s is, well, actually there are two trends, and they're linked in a kind of interesting and puzzling and ultimately very cool way, I think. First of all, when we look at buildings, the slave houses on Mulberry Row from the 1770s and 1780s, so this is when Jefferson was growing tobacco and not much else, we see that the houses have fairly large rooms. By fairly large, I mean, kind of 17 feet square. So a two-cell building would be 34 by 17.
And these are the slave homes.
Yes, these are slave houses. So these are typically they would have been made out of logs, mud chinking to sort of, in the interstices of the logs. And there's good evidence from Burn Daub that they were also then given a coating of clapboards, just riven boards, split boards, maybe covered with tar to give them a little weatherproofing. And then they would have had mud and wooden chimneys as well. So we go from in the 70s and 80s, buildings that have these larger room sizes. In the 1790s, we begin to see for the first time buildings with much smaller room sizes, 12 by 14 feet. So a considerable shrinkage in room size. And then once we get there, are a couple of slave houses that are built quite late, probably around 1809, 1810, and they're a little bit bigger again, but not as big as the early ones. So if you plot this stuff out on a graph, and we're huge on plotting stuff out on graphs because
it's the way we
just make cool discoveries about patterns. But if you plot this stuff out on the graph, it's really remarkable. You see, big rooms, it's a U shape, right? Big rooms, small rooms, and then we bounce back a little bit to slightly bigger rooms. So what's that about? Well, when we need to kind of think about, what might, if we concentrate first on just the big rooms to small rooms, What might that mean? Well, there are at least two hypotheses you can sort of think of off the top of your head. The first is that maybe the big rooms represent, multiple individuals, unrelated individuals, multiple families maybe even, housed in the same room. So you might imagine a situation in which slaves have little choice over who they live with, and they're all just kind of jammed in there.
Assigned to that building.
Yeah, assigned to that building, yeah. Maybe that, if that's right, then maybe the smaller rooms in the 1790s represent the emergence or at least the increase in frequency with which slaves could choose who they lived with, had a little more control over their living situation, and maybe a modal choice to live with family, close family members. So we might think this is the emergence of family-based housing. The second hypothesis is that, well, maybe there is no change in the kinds of social groups that are being housed. It's just that the big rooms are big and then the smaller rooms are small. And we see a kind of a situation maybe driven by Jefferson's attempts to economize of jamming the same kinds of social groups into smaller spaces. Now, the bad news, of course, is that these two hypotheses are mutually contradictory. So we need to find some independent evidence about, you know, that's going to allow us to figure out, yeah, which one is more likely
to
be.
And that's where the archaeology comes in.
Well, Coy, man, I'm glad you said that because, you know, most people, even my good friends, some of whom are historians, say, well, gee, Fraser, can't you figure that out by looking at documents? And of course, that's the wrong answer. The right answer is archaeology.
Yeah.
So we need independent archaeological evidence. And what is that? Well, one chunk of evidence comes from subfloor pits. And this is another inferential puzzle. Subfloor pits are small little storage cellars, maybe 3x3, 3x4, that are typically found under the houses in which slaves lived in the 18th century Chesapeake.
Like a little storeroom
in
the floor.
Yeah, it's a little sort of storage closet, apparently. Yeah, so slaves dug these under the floors of their houses, and they probably were covered with boards to, you know, when they weren't in use, and you could store, maybe your weekly food ration, suit of clothes.
Not a secret kind of thing.
Actually, some people have suggested that they were secret, and in fact that these are... that the reason we find these so commonly on slave sites is that slaves dug these as a way of hiding things that they had taken from their masters as a way of resisting slavery. But I think actually if you kind of think about it, you know, subfloor pits would be a really bad solution from an engineering perspective to the hiding problem. I mean, you know, if you want to hide something, you want to maximize the amount of space that the guy who's looking for it has to search. But it would seem that, you know, digging a pit in the middle of your dirt-floored house and covering it with boards would kind of be minimizing the amount of space, right? It's kind of an advertisement.
And if it was as common as archaeologists know it was, then masters would have known.
Known about it.
Hey, where's your pit?
Yeah. Exactly. And in fact, we have... So wonderful diary by Landon Carter, who was a big-time slave owner, lived on the Northern Neck. In fact, the son of the wealthiest and largest slave owner in Virginia in the 18th century, King Carter. Anyway, Landon Carter writes, this is the 1770s, he writes in his diary about a butter pot being filched from a dairy, and he suspects his slaves are responsible, and he sends his overseer, and he actually writes in his diary, I sent Billy Beale, who's his overseer, to search their holes and boxes, right? So it's the first place he tells the overseer to look. So it's kind of some people have used this as evidence that, you know, in favor of the idea that they were used as hiding places. But I think if you really think about it, given that Carter knows about them and it's the first place he tells the overseer to look, it's probably good evidence why they weren't used like this. Or if they were, people quickly figured out that that was a bad idea.
We're talking with Fraser Nyman. He's the director of archaeology at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Fraser, stay with me for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. We'll take a quick break for news and we'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now. We're talking with Fraser Nyman. He's live in studio, and he is the director of archaeology at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Fraser, before we went to a break, we were talking about how the homes of the enslaved African Americans at Monticello started out sort of big, with big rooms, got small, and then got big again. And we were talking about how the archaeology can help answer that riddle of what happened as the buildings in the landscape changed.
Right, yes. So, you'll remember we sort of had these two ideas. One was that the smaller rooms represent family-based housing and more choice for slaves. The larger rooms represent kind of barrack-style living situations, little control by slaves over who they live with. The other idea is that the smaller rooms just represent higher density and, in a sense, worse living conditions. So we need a way to pick between them. And these subfloor pits, small storage cellars underneath the floors of the building, seem to be a way to do this. But in order to take advantage of the evidence of subfloor pits, we got to figure out what they're about. So my sort of favorite idea about what subfloor pits are about is that they are what I like to call safe deposit boxes. In other words, this is a world in which people are living without locks and keys, and yet they do have a small number of personal belongings. They get a weekly food ration. There's an additional additionally their vegetables and game that they acquire for themselves. How are you going to store that stuff? And one idea is that that's what the pits are for. That by storing your stuff in a pit that everyone else who lives with you knows is yours, right? That you in a way make access to your stuff more public and visible and therefore socially accountable. So that, for example, if you and I live together and, burned through your food ration and you're not going to get any more food until, another couple of days. And I've been a little more abstemious and saved mine. That maybe you're going to be less tempted to try to take mine if, in fact, you know that mine is stored in a pit that everyone else that we live with knows is my pit, right? So
and I got to go lift the floorboards
exactly,
and make a big public deal about getting in there.
Get in there, right? Yeah. So you're more likely to be observed. It's going to be clear what you're up to. So that under this idea, subfloor pits are sort of a clever strategy invented by enslaved people in the Chesapeake to make actions more sort of socially accountable and actually to more accurately establish reputations, force other people who live with them to accurately establish their reputations. And so that may be a way to kind of bootstrap community morality in a situation when you're living with lots of other people who you don't know, if they're your friends or not.
Right.
So if this idea is right, then maybe subfloor pits are a way to try to choose between these, because these two hypotheses about the room sizes, right? Because if the big rooms are barracks-style living situations with little control, we ought to see multiple subfloor pits. If the small rooms are family-based housing, right, with more control and choice to live with your family members, fewer pits.
Less of a need to have those private spaces.
Exactly, yeah. And so, on the other hand, if the smaller rooms are just higher density of the same kinds of social groups, we ought to see the pits kind of sail right through that transition. So actually, we've got our house graph, shows shrinkage. We've now put up next to it our pit graph, right, that shows the frequency of pits under these buildings. And actually, it dives. So it looks, in other words, the buildings from the 1770s and 80s have two or four subfloor pits. The buildings from the 1790s.
When the homes got smaller.
Yeah, when the rooms got smaller, have none. And then after the 1790s, have one. And then after the 1790s, they have none. So it looks like this period in the 1790s, which is actually not coincidentally, we think, the transition from tobacco to wheat and the emergence of a more diversified agricultural economy sees the emergence of or the increased frequency with which enslaved people could live in family-based living situations and marginal marginally greater amounts of control over who they lived with.
So we start to see the culture. We're talking with Fraser Nyman of Monticello. The phone lines are open, 977-1070. In the 1790s, when we see that transition from it's all about tobacco to a more diversified agricultural product on these estates, we start to see real changes in the culture of enslaved African Americans as well towards participation in capitalism and the consumer revolution and conspicuous consumption, more evidence of nuclear family groups instead of barrack type situations. Right. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that seems to be what's going on. Now, we also in our so that seems to be the Mulberry Row situation. What's actually pretty interesting is we seem to see a parallel set of shifts in at a larger spatial scale in our settlement pattern evidence from our plantation survey. So this is now we're no longer looking at changes in houses on individual sites along Mulberry Row, but now we're moving out into the landscape and trying to find the outlying settlements on which enslaved people who actually did the agricultural labor lived.
And that's an important point folks may not know. The folks who lived on Mulberry Row weren't necessarily the people who worked in the fields.
Absolutely. And in fact, they were predominantly people who were skilled artisans or were house servants or both. So yeah, the field laborers, by and large, lived in separate settlements that were farther down the mountain and also located on the outlying quarter farms that Jefferson owned, Tufton, Shadwell, and Lego.
And there were small communities there of African Americans that lived in little homes together and would work in the fields
exactly,
during the day.
Yeah. So the way this is a system that, you know, the transition to slavery in the Chesapeake occurs in the sort of late 17th century. And at that time, you see a big increase in the size of plantations. So wealthy plantation owners after the transition to slavery own, you know, 200, 300, 400 slaves. It's simply when you have that many laborers and you're growing tobacco, you can't, it's economically crazy to try to house them all in one place and farm the fields around that single unit. People would be spending all day walking to the fields and back and no time in the fields. So slave owners are forced to divide their labor forces up and scatter them on the landscape. And what they do is they sort of invent this notion of what they call quarter farms. These are separate clusters of slave housing, the associated agricultural fields, usually livestock, and usually with a resident overseer. So Monticello was divided into four of these quarter farms, the home farm quarter, the area right around the house, and then three outlying quarter farms called Tufton, Lego, and Shadwell that were kind of managed as separate semi-autonomous units.
And each quarter farm was, you know, had multiple fields. And
exactly.
They were
huge.
Multiple
fields, yeah. They're big things. So, for example, Monticello Mountain is – it's probably around 500 or 600 acres, something like that. That's one of these units that has multiple fields, lots of livestock, and a resident overseer.
Yeah.
Now, in order to figure out what life was like for those folks, it's kind of hard because if you've ever been to Monticello, you'll know that right now Monticello is totally in forest, right? So it's really hard to find archaeological sites that way. The way we do it is actually very labor intensive, but it's been very rewarding. We do what's called shovel test pit survey, STPs for short, for shovel test pits. We dig one of these things every 40 feet.
Scourge of the universe for any undergraduate studying archaeology.
Well, exactly. But, exactly. This is very labor intensive. We dig one every 40 feet. I think we've dug now about 16,000 of them.
Oh my gosh. And for folks who don't know, this is just the way of having a little sneak peek into a little 1 foot by 1 foot square of land.
Exactly.
And then you walk down a little bit in a straight line
right.
and dig another hole.
Dig another one. Yeah. We map their locations precisely with our total station so we can come, and then the artifacts that come out of that, right, getting unique number with that pit designation on it. And so what we can do then is go back to the lab and draw maps of artifact densities across the landscape we can date those and then sort of begin to put together, you know, where people lived in 1770, where they lived in 1780, where they lived in 1800, and begin to see how settlement, slave settlement patterns change over time.
And then what we're doing now through your work and the work of your team is getting for the very first time a real look at this plantation that,
exactly,
as a whole, with all the quarter farms and all the stuff that was constantly in Jefferson's head.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, as he's trying to figure out where, what am I going to plant over here and what's going to happen over here.
And actually, that's a great point, Coy, because the, Jefferson was, a kind of documenting nut, left us this huge archive of stuff and, you know, lots of letters worrying about, you know, what am I going to plant here? You know, write letters to his overseers saying, you know, plant this here, do this there. He was a surveyor, as his father was, and got out there with his theodolite and made maps of the plantation. And, you know, so there's this enormous documentary archive. But what's really, so, you know, you might want to ask, well, gee, what can you learn doing archaeology? Well, what's very cool is, well, there are two things we can learn doing archaeology. First of all, Jefferson's surveys really only date to the 1790s. And so we don't know anything about what 1770 looked like, and we don't know much about what 1820 looked like. So that's one thing. The other thing is that Jefferson mapped overseers' houses, but he didn't map slave houses. So we're missing the part of the story that has to do with the sort of everyday lives of most of the people who lived at Monticello. So when we do our mapping and we kind of, you know, see where sites are from the 1770s and then where they are from the 1820s, what we on the Monticello home farm, what we discover is that there seem to be three principal settlements for field laborers in the 70s, and they're all pretty close together and they're right next to the overseer's house. We fast forward into the early 19th century, and we see a much larger number of domestic sites widely scattered on the landscape and much farther away from the overseer's house. So we know that during this time period, there's no change in the number of slaves that need to be housed. So this increase in the number of sites would seem to suggest that we're going from multiple, you know, clustered settlement in which each little site has multiple houses with multiple families or multiple individuals to a situation in which we've got isolated families on the landscape. So and who are at the same time much farther away from the overseer.
And that jives very well with what we were talking about earlier, that as this diversification of the agricultural economy changes and they move away from just tobacco to wheat and other items, you start seeing this whole change in culture among African Americans.
And in fact, it kind of parallels at a larger landscape scale the architectural change that we see on Mulberry Row, right? Because in Mulberry Row, if we're going from kind of multiple families in barracks to single-family houses, on the plantation, we seem to be going from multiple sort of individuals or multiple families in a settlement cluster to isolated families on the landscape. Again, in both cases, suggesting maybe a little more control over your personal space and a little more control over, you know, your living situation. And
it's the evolution of slavery, basically.
Well, it's not of slavery at Monticello, and we think there is some evidence to suspect that this is a regional Chesapeake trend. It's not just at Monticello, although we need to do a lot more work to follow that up. But there's certainly no, again, and this is where the comparative evidence becomes critical. If you look at the organization, changes in the spatial organization of sugar plantations, again, in Jamaica or Nevis, there's no change at all during this period. So again, this highlights the potential causal link to the change in crop.
From tobacco to corn.
From tobacco to wheat. And the sort of changes in slave labor work routines that presumably accompanied that.
Fraser Nyman, he's the director of archaeology at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I do want to ask you, over the years that you've worked at Monticello, has there been a favorite artifact? Has there been this one thing that's come out of the ground that you'll just never forget?
That's a great question. And I always, I think I, I'm going to answer it in a sort of funny way. Actually, I mean, as an archaeologist, I love artifacts. But what I love more is what artifacts can tell you, right? And, you know, there's all sort of saying in the business that it's not what you find that counts, it's what you find out. So my favorite artifacts, actually, they're graphs of trends, right, in the measurements that we make of the stuff that we find. So there's nothing that makes me more excited than, you know, the killer scatter plot that shows that, yeah, well, to take the Mulberry Row example again, right, that shows that U-shaped trend in the size of rooms on the one hand, and then right next to it is the total drop-off in the number of subfloor pits that really nails, or seems to nail, you know, what's the causal dynamic behind that, and what are the implications for, you know, these sort of fundamental changes in the way in which people lived.
Yeah. So when you're an old man, it's going to be those graphs. Because for you, when you look at those graphs, you see thousands of artifacts.
Well, exactly. That's the only way. I mean, that's kind of the deal. Is I think what's cool about the archaeological record is that it potentially is a far more democratic source of information about, you know, what, you know, fundamental changes in the way in which people lived on a daily basis, changes that often were so commonplace that they simply escaped the notice of people who were, you know, scribbling about them in documents. The housing change on Mulberry Row is a great example. There's absolutely no evidence of that. There's no mention of that.
And that's one of the great beauties of historical archaeology is you can get to that stuff.
You can get to that. Right.
That people didn't even think to write down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But to really get to that, right, to really see the big, large-scale changes, you've got to have data from multiple sites, right? So you have to give up. I mean, you don't have to give it up, but you have to kind of put in its place the sort of adulation of the individual cool artifact, because if you just focus on individual artifacts, you can't do these large-scale comparisons, right, that allow you to see the broad temporal and spatial patterns that really allow you to begin to say, you know, what's going on here? What's the causal economic and social
dynamic? To get you to
a
point where you can truly understand the past.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Fraser Nyman, he is the director of archaeology at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, and there's a fantastic website with all sorts of information, and we want to encourage folks to check out the visitor center, the new visitor center at Monticello, which includes, there's a lot of information there as well about the archaeology.
Absolutely, yeah. There's many of the exhibits there feature, you know, are full of artifacts that have been excavated at Monticello, and the exhibits try to suggest what they tell us about change in people's lives.
Good stuff. Fraser, thank you for being here. Really
Absolutely.
Enjoyed it.
Delighted.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.